Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The January issue of Scientific American has a really cute baby on the front, and the title of the cover story is The Pathway of Youth, New Insights into the Body's Aging Control System. The author of that piece is with us this hour of the program, David Stipp. David has a really interesting background. He's written about science, medicine, the environment, and biotech since 1982 for the Wall Street Journal, Fortune, Salon, Science, and other publications. He led Fortune's science and medical coverage from 1995 to 2005 as a senior writer and covered science and medicine as a staff reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He has, over the past decade, written extensively on the science of aging. He's also covered the Pentagon's growing concern about the risk of abrupt climate change, the application of Darwin to medicine, childhood lead poisoning, new treatments for impotence, animal intelligence, and the effects of birth order on personality. He has won the National Association of Science Writers Award for Best Magazine Article, and we are happy to have him with us this hour of the show. Our number is 800-486-8655. We should also say that he's the author of The Youth Pill, Scientists at the Brink of an Anti-Aging Revolution, published in 2010. And he has a blog you may want to follow if you find this to be an interesting conversation, which I assume you will. 800-486-8655. David, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
How old do you want to be? How old do you want to live till?
I think I would like to reach a fairly advanced age, but only if I can do it in good health.
Right.
It's the key issue, I think.
Yeah, my dad said to me toward the end of his life, don't ever get really old, Kathy. He called me Kathy. Don't ever get really old. And, I thought he was going through a lot at the end, so I think he had some fairly good wisdom. Unless we can be vital, and maybe we can, huh?
Well, it seems possible based on what we've seen in animals when we use interventions that seem to slow down their rate of aging.
Yeah. So you start your article, the Royal Canadian Navy's Cape Scott goes from Halifax, Nova Scotia to the Easter Island. And tell me about that trip and what they discovered.
Well, that trip had nothing to do with aging. It was spearheaded by a McGill University professor who had learned that out on Easter Island, which was a very remote Pacific island known for its famous stone heads, that they were going to put an airport on the island that would open it up to the modern world, so to speak, and change everything. So he had the idea that they should mount a kind of medical expedition there as well as an environmental one and just take a look and gather data on what everything was like before it was changed by this airport. And so they went to the island on this Canadian naval ship with a whole team of scientists and collected all kinds of specimens of plants and animals, as well as from the natives. They collected various medical specimens. But one of the things they did was collect soil samples. And when they brought those back, they were handed over to a pharmaceutical lab in Montreal that began to look into the possibility that there might be antibiotics or something produced by the soil bacteria. That's had been known to be a common source of antibiotics, and in fact, streptomycin had come from a soil bacterium not too long before. In any case, the Montreal drug researchers eventually just pulled out this chemical called rapamycin, that they discovered could do several interesting things. One was suppress growth of fungi. Another was suppress growth of immune cells. And in the fullness of time, the rapamycin was developed to help recipients of organ transplants, help them not undergo rejection of their transplanted organs because of it. Rapamycin was able to sort of quiet down their immune cells so their own immune cells would not attack their transplanted organs and cause all kinds of problems. So this drug actually got on the market in 1999 in the U.S. for this purpose. And I won't go into the full story on here, but on this. But over time, scientists in the early 2000s began to realize that this drug might have effects on the rate of aging. And they duly tested it in various animals, and culminating in 2009 with some very rigorous tests in mice that showed that, yes, if you give chronic doses of this drug to mice, it makes them live longer, and in a way that looks like it really does slow down their rate of aging.
And this was something that was found in this vial of dirt from the Easter Islands?
Yes. It took a number of years to actually isolate this particular compound, because they of course would analyze the soil sample looking for things in it that when they would put it in a test tube with, say, some yeast cells or some bacteria, would cause the bacteria or yeast cells to die or stop growing. And that actually, as I mentioned, it was something that was well known, that there's this kind of, it seems like there's this kind of warfare going on under our feet among the microorganisms all around us, in which some microorganisms are trying to suppress others that would occupy the same niche, so to speak. And so they clobber each other with chemical weapons, and we've been able to use some of those chemical weapons for our own purposes as antibiotics.
And was this found in dirt in other parts of the world too, or is it peculiar to Easter Island?
That's a very good question, and I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. The bacterium that makes this chemical is called Streptomyces hygroscopicus, and it, I believe, is found in other places and may well make rapamycin. But I don't think anyone has ever taken the time or whatever money it would take also to go around testing different soil samples to see if rapamycin's all over the place.
Yeah. And would it have an effect, because it's in the soil there, on the trees in Easter Island or on the animals there? Does it make trees live longer or grow bigger?
Interesting question. I don't think it's in high enough concentrations to have any effect on the fauna or flora of Easter Island. It would be something that would come into play only at the microscopic level, in very small samples of soil, I imagine, as these bacterium were trying to suppress surrounding fungi that might be enemies of in their niche.
And the mice that were tested, David, when you talk about extending the lifespan, is it that the mice didn't get diseases that are common to old age, or something else?
Well, I love that question, because it really goes right to the point of what a true anti-aging drug would do. There's only one way, really, to extend maximum lifespan. You can extend average lifespan by all kinds of things that affect animals early in life. Preventing childhood infections will increase average lifespan, but to increase maximum lifespan is very hard. And to do that, you must basically postpone the onset or avert every single disease, mortal disease of aging. If you didn't do that, of course, you wouldn't live significantly longer. Of course, the possibility that an anti-aging drug could keep an animal alive in a kind of morbid state and just prolong agony at the end. And I think a lot of people hear about this whole idea of slowing down the rate of aging, and they kind of picture that worst-case scenario. But every intervention that we know of, and there are three that are now well-known to extend maximum lifespan in animals, they all seem to merely lengthen the period of healthy life after adulthood is reached. There's no prolonging of agony. There's merely postponing the onset of the terminal decline. So it buys us quality time, in effect. Mm-hmm. And I might just add one quick thing to that. After this landmark study in mice with rapamycin, they've gone ahead and started to test its effects on diseases. And there's some significant promising evidence that it can postpone or perhaps even avert Alzheimer's disease as well as other neurological diseases.
Mm-hmm. And The length, I don't know if you've said this or not, and I didn't hear it, the period of healthy terminal decline is lengthened by how long, a significant number of years or a few months?
Well, in the mice, in us, we don't know yet, of course, whether this would work in humans, but in mice, it extended maximum lifespan by about 11.5% in this initial study, and it was actually more surprising and amazing than that because they didn't give the drug to the mice until they were 20 months old, which is the human equivalent of about 60 years, and nobody thought that anything could possibly have a significant effect on lifespan when you started that late because the damage is already done, was the conventional wisdom, but that's not the way it turned out. It actually significantly extended their lifespan. So if you translated that just by simple arithmetic to a human lifespan, that might increase our lifespans by about 9 healthy years.
That's a long time.
It is. It's very big. People think, well, I think at first glance you might think that's not so huge. But the thing is, when you're pushing back against diseases of aging, it's a really hard problem to increase lifespan because there's so many of them that are sort of out there trying to get us, so to speak.
Right.
In fact, if you could totally wipe out cancer, it's calculated it would only increase life expectancy by about 3 years.
Huh.
And the reason it's so surprisingly small is because there are so many other things trying to kill us, and their risk is rising exponentially as we get older. So something else would soon get us, even if we never, ever got cancer.
Hmm.
So, you know, in effect, what we're talking about here with this rapamycin effect in mice, if you could do it in humans, it would be like totally winning the war on cancer three times over, to put it in simple terms.
It's a big thing. Tell me about this drive for us to live longer. Do you think it's a common desire of most of us who are living right now, and who's leading the effort to keep us going longer?
Well, I think the entire field of medicine is basically about trying to make us live healthy longer. I don't think you can. It's hard to see how you could mitigate any major disease without making, you know, extending people's lives a little bit. Of course, you might merely extend their health span, as they say. And in fact, I think a lot of interventions do that. But I think at this point, when it comes to the whole anti-aging enterprise, though, there really is no major player in this game. But there are sort of bit players, so to speak. There are people who sell dietary supplements and make various not well-supported claims for those. But there's no real serious effort to develop anti-aging drugs by any sort of organization or institution that has the resources to really do the job right.
You're a major player, aren't you? At least in reporting it. Well, you are. Aren't you?
I don't think so. I'm a minor cheerleader on the side, wishing that we could move forward with this. And again, I want to stress, this is not, in my view, this is not about greatly increasing lifespan by some dramatic amount. This is about a modest increase in lifespan, but more importantly, it's about increasing healthy aging. And I would just add
right.
one quick thing that I think these anti-aging drugs, if they worked in humans, if we could prove that they did, what they would do is merely act like a preventive drug that we now use, say, to lower blood pressure or to lower cholesterol, that helps to kind of postpone the onset of heart disease or maybe sometimes completely avert it. These drugs would basically postpone the onset of everything that goes wrong as we get old. So they're just really broad scope preventive medicines that would buy us quality time and promote healthy aging, as well as perhaps lengthening our lives a bit.
Hmm. We welcome phone calls and we'll take them momentarily. Our guest this hour is David Stipp, Boston science writer who has focused on gerontology since the late 80s. He's the author of The Youth Pill, Scientists at the Brink of an Anti-Aging Revolution, and he is the author of the cover story in this month's Scientific American, The Pathway of Youth, New Insights into the Body's Aging Control System. We have one line open if you'd like to take it, 800-486-8255. 8655. And we have nonstop email space at talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The South Carolina primary is Saturday. On Monday, on our All Things Political, we'll have two guests with us from South Carolina, a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Clemson University and a professor of political science at the University of South Carolina. To your phone calls, Dan in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Kathleen, good show. I'm more interested in the quality of life as opposed to the quantity of life. I'm watching my geriatric parents. One has Alzheimer's, and the other one is his primary caregiver. I have no intention of going where they are, none. I think Jack Kevorkian was a stinking genius.
David.
Yes. I think that the issue here is exactly the one that I'm fixated on, too. I think it's all about, or not entirely, but mostly about quality of life. I just throw out one quick statistic on that's pertinent to what you're talking about. And I also have had actually two parents pass away with dementia.
Oh.
If we could replicate the anti-aging effect of this thing called calorie restriction, which is a well-known phenomenon where you can sort of put animals on very stringent diets, it lengthens their lives and also keeps them healthier as they age. If we could replicate that effect, it might have major effects on dementia. And I'll just mention one thing. The longest live population of people in the world lives on the Japanese island of Okinawa. They just have an amazing average lifespan there, and their proportion of centenarians is also by far the highest in the world. And it looks as though, in part, that's because the traditional diets in Okinawa are extraordinarily low in calories, and people believe that they probably early in their lives, the people that are now in their 90s and over 100 in Okinawa, were raised with kind of a mild form of calorie restriction. But anyway, what's truly interesting to me is that their rate of Alzheimer's disease, their prevalence of Alzheimer's disease in their 80s is half that of ours, which is, you know, it's a bit of a supposition or leap to say that if we had an anti-aging drug, it would be able to replicate that effect. But it's true that people who are extraordinarily long-lived tend to be healthier as they age, and part of that good health is that they're less susceptible to dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
Hmm. You write this interesting thing. You spend some time in the article on this calorie restriction, which you say taps an evolved, or scientists believe that it taps an evolved starvation response that breaks organisms aging during lean times so they can last long enough to reproduce when conditions improve. That's fascinating.
That's kind of the conventional wisdom on. I would just mention that idea was floated back in the late 80s, and it may well be true, but there are some problems with it, and there are some others who feel that this mechanism, the stringent dieting lengthens life, it really has some other causes that are a little bit different from that. But that theory is still very much with us.
Huh. And yet, it's hard to think that that's going to be the wave of the future. I mean, I get off the air and the first thing I want is lunch. It's fun to eat.
Oh, I agree. I tried calorie restriction once just kind of as a personal experiment
to
see what it was like. And I lasted about, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. I just couldn't get any work done. I just kept thinking, you know, I got really fixated on food.
I'll bet.
There are a few people who seem to be kind of natural-born ascetics who can do this. But, yeah, it's not for the masses. And that's why this research, in part, why this research is so interesting, because the goal would be to be able to give the gain without the pain, to find a drug that would turn on the same metabolic pathways in our cells that calorie restriction does, with the exception of the ones that make us feel hungry. It would be kind of a selective calorie restriction mimic. And it seems rapamycin might well, to some extent, be a drug that does that sort of thing, because its effects look very much like those of calorie restriction.
So they've done these studies on mice. When do they progress, and how do they progress to human beings?
Well, that's the question that I spent a lot of time thinking about, because there's a big problem here. There's a disconnect between this, to me, very exciting basic research and the possible development of it. And I think this has been going on for a number of years now. The problem is that aging is not considered a disease. It's not considered something that's treatable by thought leaders in medicine. So the thing is that the pharmaceutical industry, which is really perhaps about the only entity around that has the resources to truly test and thoroughly develop an anti-aging drug, is not interested. Because why? Well, because they could not sell an anti-aging drug as a prescription drug. And so they couldn't make enough profit as a result of that to ever recoup, you know, $2-4 billion of investment it would take to really turn this basic research into something that would provably worked. I mean, and it might take many years, too, because we still lack some tools to test these drugs, because you can't just give them to humans and wait 80 years and see if they live longer. You have to find some tools to be able to test them faster than that. And that would also take a lot of money and time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dan, for your call. Will in Madison. Hi, Will.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. We're living in very exciting times. You mentioned an island where there is this molecule that may slow down aging. There's another island that has an amazing wood, marable wood, that is going to create, it's island Cuba, a lithium-activated carbon-made battery and capacitors that we will allow us to drive our cars just on sunlight. Enough on that. I tell you the place where you go, type FINNICS and a number 7. Phoenix 7. The first paragraph has that. But anyway, I came here to the University of Wisconsin back in the 55. I worked with Joshua Lederberg, a geneticist who got a Nobel Prize, and I isolated a strain of fruit flies that lived twice their normal lifespan. But I was told not to continue it because I was instructed first to find a cure for cancer and then find a cure for aging. A little humor, but true. Now, I just got through, I was going to have January 10 a hip surgery, artificial hip. Instead, I'm one of the first Americans, guinea pig, to have bone marrow, from my bone marrow, adult stem cells taken and injected into my hip. They've done a little bit of this in China, and the cells that are remaining in the hip will give enough DNA to the adult stem cells to create all the cells that are in your hip. And they will also be able to give adult stem cells, inject them into our face skin to rejuvenate our skin, make us look young. That is the future. We're living in very exciting times.
David.
I think the research on stem cells is very exciting and interesting. I would just inject one cautionary note about this whole area as far as rejuvenation goes. Stem cells, as people may know, they have this ability to proliferate and form different specialized tissues of the body, and so they're sort of like our residual replenishing cells. And through a number of years, people have been excited about the possibility that we could tap into their power to replenish aged or injured tissues and kind of rev it up to rejuvenate them. And indeed, there's some circumstances and evidence that you can do that. But there's the risk of cancer here that we have to contend with, among others, that's very important, because any time that you rev up a cell's ability to proliferate, you kind of tip it in the direction of runaway growth, which, of course, is cancer. So this is a somewhat tricky area to capitalize on as far as being able to fight against aging, as well as I think a rather expensive area, because we need to, when you're talking about stem cells for the most part, you're talking about certain tissue types, so you have to address aging deterioration tissue and by tissue and organ by organ, so to speak. With an anti-aging drug that slows the whole aging process down, you would have a single compound that would kind of put the brakes on aging. So it would probably be a lot cheaper to go that direction.
Thanks for the call. We go to Bruce in West Allis. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I was wondering what the current status as far as resveratrol was. I heard that there were some studies that have come out recently. I wonder if there's still any promise in it. And also, I'm wondering if there's anything special that you yourself take, given your decades of research.
Let me answer briefly the resveratrol question, which is a huge issue. And I think there is a lot of promise still in resveratrol. Resveratrol made a lot of news in 2006 when it was discovered that high doses of it could extend lifespan in mice on very high-fat diets. So it wasn't necessarily an anti-aging drug, but it certainly looked promising for people wrestling with issues of obesity or other diseases brought on by overly rich diets, which is a pretty common plight these days. But it did seem like it might have some effects like calorie restriction, so it might be an anti-aging drug. So far, that hasn't panned out. Resveratrol has not been able to extend lifespan in normally fed mice. But still, there are now lots and lots of data suggesting that it, as sort of hoped, it can turn on certain pathways in the body that help to ward off heart disease and diabetes and maybe a number of other diseases of aging without necessarily being a strong candidate to actually slow the whole broad aging process itself. So the fact that we recently heard that there was, alleged fraud in some resveratrol studies is very, to me, small potatoes. That was that amount of data that was possibly involved in that is pretty trivial in the big picture on resveratrol, which, there are now, I think, about 4,400 studies on mentioning or concerning resveratrol.
That's a thing found in red wine?
Yes, it's a compound in red wine that was long associated with red wine's apparent heart benefits and then more recently has been thought maybe to be a possible anti-aging drug because it turns on certain enzymes in the body called sirtuins.
Thank you, Bruce, very much for your call. Here are some emails that have come in, many along the same lines. Mary Beth writes, my seventh grade son's science teacher told the class that fairly soon people will be able to live to 200. Several of the youngsters, including her son, had trouble sleeping and some cried. Matt sees his grandpa's Alzheimer's progressing, his grandmother's schizophrenia and dementia, and his other grandma's deafness and social isolation and joint problems, and doesn't want anything to do with living to 200. Also, assuming that we can halt all the problems of the aged as they live longer and longer, will we somehow expand health care to all citizens, or will the fountain of youth be available only to the privileged while the poor continue to be underserved?
Oh, there's seemingly a lot of questions in that.
Right.
In that. Let's see if I can parse a couple of them. Again, I would just reiterate to those who look at this whole area of research and just picture the landscape littered with really old, sick people, that's just not the way it would be if the research on animals with slowed aging is any indication. That what happens is it kind of expands that period of vibrancy in midlife. It doesn't just lengthen the period of morbidity at the end. It buys us quality time, or at least it buys the animals who have slowed aging quality time. One other quick point on that mice, calorie restricted mice, something like a fourth to a third of them, they just look amazingly healthy up until the moment they drop dead after their extended lifespans.
It's as if, you know, it's like the perfect way to go. You're just perfectly, you know, you're partying along one day, and then the next day, you know, you're dead. There's no terminal decline at all in these animals. And, in fact, after death, they do necropsies, which is, you know, it's kind of like the animal version of an autopsy, and they can't find any signs of serious disease at all in them. It's a bit of a mystery why they die at all. I'm not saying that this necessarily would play out in humans, but it suggests that if we could get a true anti-aging drug that works the way calorie restriction does in animals, we might be able to get this effect where you call, sometimes people call it the Von Hoff-Shea effect after a poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes about a cart that fell apart all at once after lasting for 100 years. We might get this, I think what a lot of people envision is the perfect way to live and die, to be well up until near the end. As to the other issues, people ask a lot of questions as I've talked to them about this issue, about, you know, environmental problems, providing health care. Of course, there would be some downsides. I don't think there's any way to have all this gain you could have without downsides. I think there would be additional costs for health care, even if people are living healthy during their longer lives, because there would be probably more people alive for a bit longer. So there probably would be some increases in healthcare costs. Although I would hasten to add that maybe that's not such a horrible thing. I mean, what else do we spend money for if we're not to buy, you know, healthy years of life? What would be more valuable than that? Population pressures come up a lot, and I have a lot or many thoughts on that, but I would just, you know, sort of summarize and say that we have seen, you know, the world population grow very dramatically without the aid of any anti-aging drugs, and we're now in a position where populations around the world are aging at a very fast rate, mainly because fertility is falling out at this point. And I think we're already facing the problems of aging and population because of that. And I think one way to help avert those problems or deal with them is to increase the amount of healthy aging that's already sort of going to happen, irrespective of anything else that we do. Mm-hmm. And that's what these drugs would do. So I think on balance, they would actually help with a lot of the problems that we foresee, simply because they would help us deal with problems that we're already going to face because we're getting older or we're living longer.
I'm still thinking about that mouse. How did that mouse die? What do people think?
There's some theories about that. I'll just mention one, how this proportion of mice that just sort of dropped dead without showing signs of being sick before they die. It may be that there are transient changes in blood sugar that happen. Their blood sugar levels may become unstable as they get really, really old and decrepit. And so they look fine and they probably feel fine most of the time, but there may be a day when something happens that causes their blood sugar to dip significantly. This is just, you know, a theory.
Right.
No one knows whether it's true. Yeah. And that could cause cardiac arrest very, you know, suddenly and cause this kind of appearance of dying suddenly with no prior illness.
Mm-hmm. Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am vitamin B12 deficient. I found out about 5 years ago. I was very sick. I was very confused. I couldn't remember anything. I was really, really falling down. And finally, after I hurt myself, my doctor ordered a B12 check on my blood, vitamin B12, and I was 160, and low normal is 300. And my neurologist said, this can cause all sorts of things to go wrong, I guess even Alzheimer's. And now my husband, 79, been moping around here for close to a year, tired, fatigued like I was, and he finally, his doctor ordered a B12 check, vitamin B12 check, and he was 133, and he had to go on shots, too, and it's something that's very common in elder in people over 60, and younger people get it too. Your body does not absorb the B12 from your food. It goes right through your system, out the stool, and Medicare will not pay for that.
All right, let's talk about vitamin B12. David?
Well, it's not a subject I know a lot about. I certainly know of what you're talking, this phenomenon of malabsorption, I guess the doctors would call it, of B12. And I think a lot of elderly people also have low levels of some other key vitamins or in a high proportion, like vitamin D. And certainly a problem. And it gets into the larger issue of whether it makes sense for a lot of us just to take a multivitamin every day as a kind of general preventive measure for such things as B12 deficiency as we get older. That's a rich subject, and I'm not wanting to wade into it too far, nor to give recommendations. But I do find some of the arguments in favor of that fairly compelling, despite some contrary evidence that multivitamins don't do any good, and some recent evidence that they might even be slightly harmful, which I don't think is very compelling. But it's a mixed picture, and certainly, though, for anybody with a demonstrable deficiency, if your doctor measures and shows that you're deficient, yeah, it absolutely makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you for the call. We are talking this hour with David Stipp. He is a Boston science writer who's penned the current Scientific American cover story on the pathway of youth, new insights into the body's aging control system. David has been interested and written about this subject for a number of years now. You may want to go to his blogs, because they're very interesting. They're about aging science or the science of learning about aging. It's at David Stipp, STIPP. It's all together, davidstipp.com. Fascinating stories. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Paul in Menominee, our next caller. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was wondering, Dave, what the current theory or thinking is on why a 6 or 8 pound mammal will live 10 years and a vulture or a parrot of the same weight size will live 80 years.
I love that whole subject. It really is fascinating that it seems that certain animals live much longer than they should based on their body weight. That is the preface to this whole conversation is that, in general, bigger animals live longer. And you can just see that by comparing, looking at rodents, like mice live a couple of years, maybe three, and somewhat larger animals like cats and dogs live, 10, 20 years. Horses live 30 years. Elephants live 40, 50, we 60 years. And humans, of course, live quite a bit longer, even though we're not all that big. Just to cut to the chase on this issue, it seems that evolution gears our rate of aging as a species depending on how much risk of death we face just from things in the environment. So if you're a little animal, a little prey animal like a mouse, it doesn't make much sense for evolution to endow you with a lot of fancy gear in your cells to make your rate of aging very slow, because you're going to get killed. Your owl is going to pick you off. You're going to die of winter cold or starvation pretty fast. So what it makes sense is for you to develop really fast and make babies as fast as you can. For an animal that's resistant to these sort of external causes of mortality, it makes sense for evolution to gear you to age slowly. So there are some animals that are extraordinarily resistant to predation, to predators, because of various tricks they have, like porcupines live a long time, extraordinarily long for their size, because for maybe obvious reasons. And flying animals in general live an extraordinarily long time for their size. Bats, in particular, in fact, the most extraordinarily long-lived
animal known to science was a Siberian bat that was discovered just a few years ago. It lived over 40 years.
Woo!
They know this because it was banded. Now, a bat, this is an animal that whose total body weight is smaller than that of a mouse. It's just a little tiny creature.
Huh.
And it lives, you know, well over 10 times as long as a mouse. So, you know, I think the short answer is basically animals that are good at fending off predators or winter cold or whatever, which, by the way, we humans are very good at, tend to live longer.
Huh. Fascinating. Thank you for the call. Here's an email from Nancy. Her husband, she says, is a scientist, worked as the chief of comparative medicine at the National Institute of Aging, and has followed a caloric restrictive eating regime since his time there about 8 years ago. It's amazing how quickly he heals from illnesses and injuries. He's written on the topic, and the scientific evidence is strong. He breaks his fast about 5 p.m., and then watch out. You don't want to be behind him in the buffet line. It'll be hard to convince the American public about its health benefits since eating is such a social thing. And then she also writes, "This is I've never heard of such a thing. My husband will be doing this procedure with stem cells, but with a dog, to help with a knee injury in my daughter's one-year-old Airedale dog with 4 injections of stem cells from her fat into the knee. We are hoping to ward off surgery."
Very, boy, a lot of interesting things there. Let me just seize on one thing, this wound healing thing. This is a big issue in this whole calorie restriction area, and also with rapamycin, this drug that extended lifespan in mice. And that is that calorie restriction tends to actually make wound healing go slower, as well as rapamycin does the same thing, because both of them sort of have this effect of suppressing cell growth. And so wound healing in a calorie-restricted animal tends to take longer, and that can be problematic if you're injured. However, in keeping with what he just said, or what he was quoted as saying, it seems that both of these things, since they slow down aging, they preserve the kind of latent capacity of tissues to heal themselves. So what can happen is if you have a calorie-restricted animal that's wounded, if you just start feeding it real fast, it'll heal faster than an animal that hasn't been calorie-restricted that's the same age. And probably something similar would happen with rapamycin treatment. You would have this kind of preserved ability to heal that you could switch on just by removing the slow growth mode or the calorie restriction.
Well, Nancy, have your send us some more material on that, because it would be interesting to read his writing and perhaps do an interview down the road. Our number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open right now, and we go to Jean in Ashland. Hi.
Hi. Two questions. The French woman that died at the age of 122, I believe, Jean Calment, I never see a biography for the general public. I've always looked for it. She must have been studied a great deal by researchers. And the other thing is, are you familiar with the geriatrician William H. Thomas, M.D., and his books? I'm reading his book titled "What Are Old People For?" subtitled "How Elders Will Save the World."
I like that, since I'm getting fairly old myself. I think that a lot there was quite a bit of attention paid to Jean Calment, but I think that we don't really know all that much about, you know, whether she had special genes that may have enabled her to live to 122 or just what it was. It is interesting, though, that one of the things that jumps out when I think about her and some other really very long life people is that there's no single lifestyle factor that seems to account for these extraordinarily long life people. For instance, she was a smoker up until very late in her life, which is something I kind of hesitate to say because I don't want to encourage smoking. But I think the point is that she probably did possess some special gene variants that made her extremely slow aging. And you know, we're beginning to get a handle on some of these in studies of centenarians, people who lived over 100. But one of the things they do is they just enable you to do lifestyle things that would get most people into trouble. You know, I would think most people who don't possess these specially protective genes would not be able to be smokers and live that long, for example. And I'm sorry, I don't know the works of William Thomas. It sounds like an interesting subject, though, that, from the title of his book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call. Linda in Bristol. Hi, Linda.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I was thinking about this before a prior caller, talking about the length of life of everything, and in particular, I've been interested for years in the anomaly of the redwoods. And, I mean, I just find it fascinating, and I don't know whether anybody's done any studies as to why they live so long, and there are no other trees that come anywhere close to that length of time. I mean, I think other trees, you know, the longest is maybe a couple hundred years. And, you know, see about the soil issues, et cetera. So I think it's a fascinating area.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there is very much known about plant aging. I think almost everyone who studies aging has mainly studied animals, since, you know, perhaps obviously it would have seeming more application to human medicine. But it's a very interesting subject. On its face, given that the very oldest living creatures we know are I think bristlecone pines, and obviously these very large redwoods are, as you say, very long life too. And it would be, I think, a fascinating question to just try to look into and analyze exactly what's going on at the cellular and molecular level that enables these organisms to survive so long and have their cells continue to proliferate that long.
Thank you so much for your interesting call. From Anne in Madison, let me spell this for you. I'm not sure how to pronounce it in Italian. Stoccaredo. Stoccaredo or something like that. Italy being studied. People there eat a high-fat diet, no calorie restrictions, and reportedly live the longest, healthiest lives of anywhere on Earth.
I could believe it might be true. I'm not familiar with those data. Let me just relate one quick anecdote from my own life about diet and long life. I got to know some centenarians in the course of my reporting over the years who were taking part in research on what makes people who live that long able to do that. And one of them I sort of befriended, and they're just delightful people, I have to say, really delightful. And she, you know, I took her out to lunch and one day, and we were sitting there at the restaurant, and she orders this giant platter of fried fish and chips and everything. And I'm sitting there with my chaste little salad, you know, and I look over and I say, "Catherine, is this the way you always eat?" And she said, "Yeah, I always ate whatever came along as long as it wasn't moving." And I think this goes back to the point I was talking about Gene Kelman being a smoker. These people probably possess gene variants that are just kind of making them able to resist the ravages of time in ways that us normal people can't, or those of us that don't have all these this genetic endowment. And so she, and I know of other cases like this, centenarians that have just eaten terribly. I mean, their diets have just been horrible. And yet they have not suffered from heart disease, early heart disease. They may have had heart disease very, very late. There's something going on with the way their bodies handle lipids and atherosclerosis and everything, and it probably has a genetic basis.
Dave in Genesee. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and great show. I was wondering what the effects of epigenetics have on the healthful aging, and that the data collection with all this information, I think it's the key to the answers to so many of the questions that we have. But has epigenetics been studied in regards to rapamycin?
All right, we have a minute left, D.
Okay. That's a big question.
you know, epigenetics has come up a bit. Epigenetics, by the way, is just sort of alterations to genes that aren't embedded in the normal sequence of the genes. And I'll just mention one thing that I know of. It turns out that, you know, the sirtuins we spoke of earlier that are related to resveratrol, these affect acetylation, if you know about the molecular biology of epigenetics. And so it may be that this particular aspect of aging, or the sirtuins, may have something to do with epigenetics, and some of the effects they have may be related to their epigenetic effects as well as their non-epigenetic effects. So anyway, it's a very interesting subject, a big one, and it may turn out to be extraordinarily important, but I don't think much is known at this point.
David, thank you so much. What an interesting hour. And your website's great, too, so we direct people there. David Stipp, the cover story of Scientific American, The Pathway of Youth, New Insights into the Body's Aging Control System, and his website is davidstipp, STIPP.com. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll be with you on Monday, All Things Political, looking at the South Carolina primary.